my pleasure to welcome you to this public lecture on behalf of the Department of International Relations, which I'm the convener. My name is Christopher Hill, and also the European Institute. There's probably no more important question today in contemporary Europe, perhaps in contemporary international relations, than the condition of Germany. Perhaps everything else depends on the condition of Germany. The future of the European Union, the development of Eastern and Central Europe, perhaps even the fate of Russia. And yet at the same time, we expect a great deal of Germany, perhaps too much, whatever our starting point. Is Germany indeed in a condition today to provide leadership for Europe, for general trends in international relations, and to deal with the kind of crisis that Mr. Marsh is going to talk to us about today? Now, in fact, we are fortunate indeed in having David Marsh with us tonight, somebody eminently qualified to discuss the condition of Germany and its leadership capacity. David Marsh is one of Britain's most distinguished journalists. Indeed, a recent survey placed him joint fifth, I think, among the world's most influential financial journalists. My reaction to this information, which I must say I read in the Financial Times, was to say only fifth or only joint fifth. Surely a little better. But clearly, this was a survey amongst the world's leading financiers and opinion formers, and this is what counts. Mr. Marsh was originally a student of chemistry at Oxford. Students of chemistry at Oxford sometimes have strong opinions on Germany. For those of you who don't know, Mrs. Thatcher was, of course, a chemistry student at Oxford. He's come a long way since those days, not actually all that long ago. He's had a distinguished career in the Reuters news agency, serving in London, Brussels, Frankfurt and Bonn. But he has been, since 1978, with, of course, the Financial Times. He served in London first, he then went to Paris. He was chief German correspondent between 1986 and 1991, a rather crucial period. Since 1991, he has been European editor in London. He's won several important prizes in journalism, and he has, of course, published several books, including one on the New Germany in 1990, The Bundesbank, The Bank That Rules Europe in 1992, which led him, I believe, among other things, to debate with the president-designate of the Bundesbank in 1993 before 2,000 German industrialists, after which tonight will seem like a tea party, I think. And, of course, his present book, Germany and Europe, The Crisis of Unity, which he will sign for you outside. So it's with pleasure and, of course, anticipation that I turn to David Marsh to lecture to us tonight to the title, Is Germany Leading Europe Out of the Crisis? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for that very impressive introduction. I'm really full of anticipation myself after hearing that. I have to say the sample that you mentioned was in fact a rather low sample of people, and my wife wasn't at all impressed by that result. I'm very pleased that the title of the lecture tonight has got a question mark after it, and in fact that was the one thing I did insist upon several months ago when agreeing to do this, that there should be a question after this, because I don't know really whether I'm going to come up with a great many answers. I may well simply have added to the questioning. I'm very pleased to be here tonight, and I remember the last time I was here, Carl Otto Pöhl was giving two lectures in the lecture theatre, and I was amazed at how well his jokes went down in the lecture theatre at the end of last year. So if I can follow on that performance, I'll be very pleased. But tonight I should like to talk above all about Germany and its role in Europe 5 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall and 4 years after unification. And I want to touch on a number of subjects. One is the question of a contradiction between widening the European integration towards Central and Eastern Europe and deepening it amongst the present 12 members of the European Union or the European Community. And there is a conflict of interest here, I think. And this partly reflects the new contradiction between Germany's duties and desires vis-à-vis its partners in the west of the continent, and those vis-à-vis its partners and neighbours to the east. And because the political geometry of Europe has so greatly changed since the opening of the centre of the, and the east of the continent, and this is all a process which we all greatly welcome, Germany is now under the influence of a new pattern of attractions and responsibilities in its relations with east and west. So I'd like to address in particular four questions. The first one is, what role did Germany's neighbours and partners play in the process of German unification? How did this help trigger the plan for economic and monetary union at the heart of the Maastricht Treaty? The second one is also slightly historic. It's really to focus on the Chancellor Kohl himself. What impact did he make on the course of unification? What was his responsibility for the achievements and also for the mistakes made along the way? And this will give us some pointers, I think, to the future. The third question is really, what has been the balance sheet so far of German and European unification since those heady days in 1989? And this is a process which, as Mr. Kohl has always reminded us in one of his folksy metaphors in which he excels, he has always said that German unification and European unification should be two sides of the same coin. And I'd like to examine whether that really is the case. And the fourth question, and this is really where we come to the heart of the matter, what is the outlook for Germany and Europe as the result of the October the 16th elections last Sunday, which, as you all know, resulted in a wafer-thin majority for Chancellor Kohl, but one nonetheless which he was showing a good deal of happiness about when one saw him beaming on the television on Sunday night and also on Monday. And, of course, this question, what is the outlook, also includes the prospects of further Euro strife in the British Conservative Party. First, though, before going into that, I just want to plough back into history a little while to illustrate a tale of two chancellors, recalling two speeches made to the German Parliament over the course of slightly more than a century. And I think just examining those two speeches tells us quite a lot about the way Germany has become in those 100 years. The first speech was by Bismarck on the 6th of February 1888. And I quote from Bismarck's speech, which is my own translation, because he probably spoke far better English than I did. But he said, "When I say that we must always be prepared for all eventualities, I am voicing the expectation that we must make greater efforts than all other states devote to this purpose. This is because of our geographical position. We lie in the middle of Europe. We have at least three fronts for attack. France has only her eastern border. Russia only her western border across which she can be attacked. As the result of the whole development of world history, of our geography, and of the German nation's shortcomings in cohesiveness, we are more exposed to the danger of coalitions than any other people. God has placed us in a situation in which we are prevented by our neighbours from in some way descending into sloth or dullness. He has placed to the one side of us that most warlike and unquiet of nations, the French, and he has allowed bellicosity to rise up in Russia to an extent not seen in previous centuries. So we feel the spurs on both sides. He said, die Hechte im europäischen Karpfenteich hindern uns, Karpfen zu werden. The pikes in the European carp pond prevent us from ever becoming carp, for they project their spikes into both our flanks. They force us into efforts to which we would voluntarily perhaps not be disposed, and they force us to hold together as Germans, something that runs counter to our inner nature, for otherwise we like to go our own ways." End of quote. And the Reichstag document of the time recorded Heiterkeit, laughter, at this last point. I'd just like to compare that with Helmut Kohl's speech, which in fact was in the newly rebuilt Reichstag, although it was to the Bundestag, one day after German unification 4 years ago, on the 4th of October 1990. And again, I quote, "We have always been aware that the German path to unity has raised questions among many people in Europe and elsewhere, and has led to disquiet and even fears. We understand and we respect these feelings. But we must also bear in mind the Federal Republic's experience during more than 40 years of stable democracy in a state governed by law. The coming years will show that united Germany brings a benefit for the whole of Europe. Within Germany and outside, we strive to be good neighbours. Germany will not go down a special path. There will be no go-it-alone nationalism. We want to serve the cause of world peace. Our goal of European Union should serve as a solid foundation of, and also as the nucleus for, the growing together of the whole of Europe. Along with France, we are determined to create a European confederation in which all states will cooperate on an equal basis. End of quote. What a difference a century makes. Chancellor Kohl's statement 4 years ago underlines the essential points about the European strategy of today's Germany. Like Bismarck, Kohl is only too well aware of the vulnerabilities of Germany's geographical position and of the suspicions and anxieties of Germany's neighbours. These feelings, of course, have been amplified by this century's two world wars. Bismarck's answer to the danger of coalitions was to play the game of the balance of power, to use Germany's might and its strategic position at the centre of the continent as a form of juggling peg in the competition and in the composition of European politics. This was a game which Bismarck played with a certain success, but certainly under the devil-may-care adventurism of Wilhelm II, and even more under Hitler, it was a game that Germany played twice and ultimately and disastrously lost. Now, Kohl's policy, of course, is different. Following on from the stance set down after the Second World War under Adenauer, and indeed a course which was forced upon Germany by defeat and division, Kohl, like all West German chancellors before him, spurned any thought of destabilizing competition. Whereas Bismarck exhorted the Germans to stand on their own feet, Kohl rejects what he would call go-it-alone nationalism. Trading on Germany's good name, built up after four decades of unprecedented stability, prosperity, and democracy in the western part of the nation, Kohl rejects the language of pikes in the pond, and instead he embraces that of good neighbours, a phrase which comes up again and again in German political rhetoric. And it was a form of rhetoric which, one is bound to say, has proved greatly more successful than Bismarck's. But it has only succeeded because the rhetoric has been backed up by action and by thought in Bonn. The Germans after the war abandoned adventurism and they turned towards benign economic solidity. They have rejected motorized warfare for motorized holidays. And they have actually proved that Hitler once again was standing on fairly shaky ground when he said more than 50 years ago that it was impossible to make foreign conquests by economic means. Germany's conquests are through the export of refrigerators and washing machines and cars and investment goods, but they are nonetheless conquests of a more benign form. Now, the neighbours of whom there has been so much talk were of great relevance 5 years ago when in September 1989, 30,000 dissatisfied East Germans started to wash through to the Federal Republic via the newly porous but still communist states of Hungary and Czechoslovakia. The neighbours had to be of relevance when Germany started to unite. How could this otherwise not have been the case? It was always clear that German unification would have to take place in a European context, not least because the four erstwhile allies of the anti-Hitler coalition of the Second World War, the United States, Soviet Union, Britain and France, still held the key in their hands to the final disposal of German sovereignty. And the three Western allies, the United States, Britain and France, were co-signatories, after all, of the Bonn Convention, the Deutschlandvertrag, a treaty that came into effect in 1955, in which they undertook to work for a unified Germany that would be, quote, integrated into the European community, lowercase c, end quote, and possess, quotes, a liberal democratic constitution, end quote. Until the chance of unity actually arose, many in Germany surmised that this promise might add up to little more than empty words, a view that at least in the case of the political leadership of Britain and France turned out to be correct. Mrs. Thatcher, as you know, had few qualms in admitting that these post-war pro-unification pledges were not to be taken seriously. In September 1989, 2 months before the Berlin Wall fell, as the flood of departing East Germans brought the theme of unification back to the headlines for the first time in a generation, Thatcher made a brief visit to Moscow, telling Mr. Gorbachev, as she later set down in her memoirs, and I quote, although NATO had traditionally made statements supporting Germany's aspiration to be reunited, in practice, we were rather apprehensive, end quote. Now, Mrs. Thatcher's desire to slow down unification was, she claimed later, based partly on the belief that it would undermine Gorbachev and set back détente. However, her actual words in 1989, 1990, in a series of interviews and statements, including some very important words which she said on the Jimmy Young program, which is where she reserved most of her important policy statements, in a number of these interviews, she made very clear that her overriding reason was the fear that a united Germany would be, quotes, stronger than all the others, end quotes, and, quotes, a very dominant nation, end of quote. Now, Thatcher's candor in refusing to hide her feelings behind diplomatic subterfuge or the normal sort of niceties both irritated Kohl and won his grudging respect. In fact, I was in the Chancellor's office in September last year when a copy of Mrs. Thatcher's memoirs actually arrived, signed to dear Helmut from Margaret. And Kohl was very nice about Mrs. Thatcher and said she was the only one who was honest at the time. But it was irritation, I do stress, as well as respect. And Thatcher's visit to Kohl's hometown in the Rhineland-Palatinate in April 1989 offered several revealing examples of their capacity for mutual misunderstanding. I was lucky enough to be at that visit. At the welcoming ceremony, this was in a small town in Germany, quite near where Mr. Kohl hails from, Mrs. Thatcher looked around at all the wine on the table, the flowers, the pleasant atmosphere, and spoke of her great pleasure at being in France. that remark, I don't think, was translated. She used most of the visit to lecture Kohl on the importance of modernizing short-range missiles stationed in Germany, a course to which the Chancellor was ill-disposed. During a brief tour of the nearby Speyer Cathedral, Kohl took Charles Powell, Thatcher's private secretary, behind a coffin and said that all this was to show Mrs. Thatcher that he was as much European as German. And that this gesture failed to make any impact. And Powell actually told me that on the aeroplane home on the way back to Bryce Norton, or wherever it is, Mrs. Thatcher leant back on the aeroplane seat, kicked off her high-heeled shoes and exclaimed, "Isn't Kohl so German?" A few years ago, I referred during a conversation with President von Weizsäcker to Mrs. Thatcher's well-known suspicions of the Germans, and Mrs. Thatcher, I ventured, tended to look at the rest of Europe from the viewpoint of 1940. More like 1941, the President replied. By then, the English were winning. France demonstrated a different kind of sensitivity. In view of the country's threefold experience of German invasion since 1870, the concerns went deeper and wider. But they were also expressed more subtly, and they were linked at least to a commitment to counter the risks of unification through a policy of binding Germany into a more integrated Europe. Now, if this was a special relationship between France and Germany, between Charles, it was rather in the footsteps of Charles de Gaulle and Konrad Adenauer, it was also a very delicate and many-layered relationship. Founding fathers of the European community, partners in bilateral cooperation after the signing of the Élysée Treaty in 1963, France and West Germany had become joint pursuers of the holy grail of European unity. But there was another side to this relationship which was geared much less to trust than to a certain form of foreboding. Throughout the whole post-war period, Bonn needed to demonstrate and Paris needed to be told that Germany would no longer be a danger to European stability. The greater Germany's power, either real or perceived, the more pressing would be France's requirement for reassurance. And as Germany started to come together 5 years ago, outwardly, Mitterrand's performance was relaxed. In November 1989, less than a week before the wall fell, he was the first Western leader publicly to forecast German unification. I was actually at a press conference in Bonn where he said, "I am not afraid of German unification." Subsequently, it was claimed by Jacques Attali, one might say perhaps a slightly less than reliable source, that Mitterrand foresaw as early as 1981 that a coming collapse of the Soviet Empire would make German unification inevitable within a generation. So Mitterrand did seem to be far-sighted, certainly more far-sighted than Mrs. Thatcher. In fact, he was less composed and less confident than such remarks might have suggested. His private anxieties did seem to have been comparable to those far more outspokenly outlined in public by Mrs. Thatcher. Concerned, like Mrs. T, that German unification could destabilize Gorbachev, Mitterrand flew to Kiev in December 1989 to discuss Germany's future with the Soviet president. Gorbachev appears to have made an impassioned plea for German help, for French help, in avoiding unification. And this visit, along with Mitterrand's well-known journey to East Berlin later on in that month, strengthened the impression that France wished to preserve for as long as possible the old constellation of European power. And this had a lot to do with the Maastricht Treaty, as I'll try to explain later. One should mention perhaps just one more point about French policies towards Germany in 1989. France's worries about German unpredictability were increased in early 1990 by Kohl's delay in confirming the inviolability of Poland's western border, fixed in 1945 after the Polish annexation of German territory, an action which, although part of the de facto war settlement, had never been upheld in international law. Kohl was, of course, pressed by domestic right-wingers' agitation for the reintegration of the eastern territories, but he did maintain unnecessary ambiguity about whether United Germany would seek to renegotiate its eastern border with Poland for far too long. He waited until March 1990 before stating formally that Germany had no claims on the former German lands in the east. This, I submit, was one of Kohl's very few miscalculations along the otherwise near faultless path that unification took in 1990. Other mistakes in the economic field we'll talk about later, but on the political side he did show almost flawless handling of the issue. One has to mention too that when one talks to Mrs. Thatcher these days about her policies towards Germany, she does tend to roll her eyes and say, it wasn't just me, it was Mitterrand. I experienced this myself about 10 days ago. And Kohl certainly does remember this too, and this does have an impact, I think, still, not only on Germany's policies towards Britain, but on Germany's policies towards France. The Chancellor's view is that the only European leader to provide genuine support for German unification 4 or 5 years ago was Felipe González in Madrid. Now, while Thatcher offered blind hostility, which was moderated only slightly after the 2+4 talks got underway in spring 1990, Mitterrand did at least have a strategy. The binding in process through Maastricht provided the French means to try to counter Germany's renascent power. Of course, German unification wasn't the only reason for the plan for economic and monetary union. Negotiations, after all, started well before the Berlin Wall crumbled. But the objective of EMU gained renewed backing, particularly from the French and Italian governments and also from the European Commission, during the process of German unification. The aim of establishing a European central bank and a single European currency that would take over the roles played by the Bundesbank and the D-Mark were really part and parcel of the idea of binding Germany firmly towards the West. This was by no means a new policy, and it was also not a policy to which the Germans themselves showed any great antipathy. Helmut Schmidt has admitted that as long ago as in 1978-1979, one of the principal thoughts that he had in mind when he and Giscard d'Estaing set up the European monetary system was to bind Germany in, to anchor Germany in to the West. This was Helmut Schmidt's own policy. But the momentum behind the objective redoubled as German unification came into view. It was given new momentum, and we saw as the result the Maastricht Treaty agreed in December 1991, when for the first time a date was agreed, 1997 or 1999, for economic and monetary union to enter into force. The monetary union plan was therefore not, as the late Nicholas Ridley said in 1990, a German racket to take over Europe. If one wanted to use Ridley-esque language, one would say it was a Franco-Italian racket to take over the D-mark. Now, from the German point of view, this plan was akin to self-emasculation. Nonetheless, the German government was its greatest supporter. And the reason for this was during and immediately after the process of German unification, the Germans wanted to use the EMU proposals to show to their partners, and maybe also to themselves, that the new United Germany would be just as reliable, just as Western-orientated as West Germany had been throughout the whole of those years of division. EMU represented, in geopolitical terms, a continuation of the strategy of European reinsurance and reassurance. Last month's celebrated paper on European integration from the CDU-CSU parliamentary grouping in Bonn, to which I will make further reference later, makes clear the need to anchor Germany into the West abundantly clear, perhaps in terms which are somewhat painful. And I quote from the paper written by Wolfgang Schäuble and Karl Lamers. I quote, "Never again must there be a destabilizing vacuum of power in Central Europe. If West European integration were not to progress, Germany might be called upon or tempted by its own security constraints to try to effect the stabilization of Eastern Europe on its own and in the traditional way." End of quotation. And I really do ask myself what good spelling out the apparent lack of trust in Germany itself by two foremost German politicians, what good such papers actually produce. And I do also ask myself whether the majority of the present German electorate would actually agree that Germany somehow needs to be kept back like some sort of devil that will rise up again, has to be restrained from following some kind of evil notion of, I quote, effecting the stabilization of Eastern Europe on its own and in the traditional way, end quote. I really do ask myself whether such a statement is still in line with reality. But anyway, there you are, that was the statement. So the Germans agreed to EMU. But they did agree to monetary union and the abandonment of the D-mark coming about only if very tough conditions could be fulfilled. And I do submit that these conditions were so tough that they will not be fulfilled. These conditions center on the celebrated convergence criteria on inflation, interest rates, fiscal performance. The Germans also made clear 3 years ago that monetary union could only be countenanced if it were embedded into a full-scale political union in Europe. These conditions, at least at present, are far from being achieved. And my own law on this subject would be that there are always five German conditions for monetary union which will not be achieved in the next 5 years. I think we can take that as a form of stability. I want to go a little bit, as I said earlier, into the role of Mr. Kohl 5 years ago, because this tells us something about what will happen in the next 5 years. Chancellor Kohl was always a believer in unity to the extent that he kept alive the thought that there was a common bond of responsibility that linked East and West. He used the word Einheit der Nation. He did not use the word Wiedervereinigung, reunification. He kept that out of his political vocabulary up until those refugees started to cross in August 1989. He certainly had no special insight into what was going on in Eastern Germany, and nor did he forecast it. I know this because I used to annoy him all the time by asking him about unification. And in 1988, I asked him at a press conference in Moscow whether he would live to see unification. And he replied that he didn't think that he would live to see unification. I believe Mr. Gorbachev, with whom he had just had a conversation, might have actually told him that during that discussion. Therefore, that would be one of the reasons for the Chancellor's answer. Later, at the end of 1990, after unity had actually been forged, I asked the Chancellor again about this comment he made only a couple of years earlier, and he explained with a politician's typical use of flexible language that he had meant he would not live to see unification as Chancellor. So the paradox of unification was that West Germany's 1949 constitution proclaimed the unity and the freedom of Germany as the supreme national goal. Yet many came progressively to fear that an attempt to realize this might overturn all that the country had built up over 40 years. The ending of division illustrated that the nation could really only become whole again once it had ceased to think and behave as a nation. And as long as the bipolar post-war system of the superpowers remained in place, the German Democratic Republic did not look unstable. Only once radical signs of détente between the US and the Soviet Union became evident in 1988 and 1989 did Germany's weakness become increasingly exposed. There was a parallel miscalculation in both East and West. Neither of the two German states seemed fully aware of the extent of mounting economic and political pressure in East Berlin. The shock was therefore all the greater when the world discovered the shallowness of East Germany's foundations. As Kohl himself put it in 1990, for a long period, East Germany appeared like a monolith, but it was a house of cards, and it fell down. So my thesis is that Germany's lack of preparation for unification clearly hampered the chances of mastering the consequences and have made the last 4 or 5 years more difficult, both for Germany and Europe, than would otherwise have been the case. And yet this very unpreparedness played a vital role in making unification possible. When Chancellor Kohl came to power in 1982, he continued the fundamental tenets, in most cases, of the policies of his predecessors, both Willy Brandt and Schmidt, of building up good neighborly relations with East Germany. The somewhat surreal transcript of a telephone conversation in 1983 between Chancellor Kohl and Erich Honecker, the East German leader, published a few weeks ago in Der Spiegel, provided just one indication of how normal and neighborly these relations had become. The main subject of conversation appeared to be the weather. Without a tacit acceptance in the 1970s and the 1980s by successive Bond governments, both led by the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, that German division was part of the post-war European status quo, I don't believe that relations between the two then superpowers would ever have improved sufficiently to allow that status quo to be overturned. And had Kohl or anyone else possessed anything remotely resembling an operational plan to take over East Germany, this plan, I think, would have crumbled under an onslaught of suspicion and opposition at home and abroad and wouldn't have been put into place. But, of course, the underestimation of the economic problems resulting from unification has cast a cloud over the aftermath, both for Germany and for Europe. Chancellor Kohl, in 1990, and this was his greatest mistake, held up the prospect that living standards in East Germany could be raised to West German levels within 4 or 5 years, and he also promised that the entire procedure could be financed without any increase in taxation. Now, these two forecasts, simply taken by themselves, appeared implausible. That they would both become true simultaneously was hugely unlikely. Kohl's judgment was also that European and German unifications could somehow be brought together in tandem, the two sides of the famous coin, and that they could both be completed by the end of the century. Thus, the Maastricht timetable for monetary union and political union by 1999. This was also a misjudgment. One other point needs to be made, perhaps. The foreign perceptions of the sort harbored by Mrs. Thatcher, that united Germany would smoothly and automatically extend its might and become, almost overnight, the European superpower, tended in a way to reinforce the confidence of politicians in the West German government that unification would be relatively free of stress. Both these were illusions, but they did tend to prove mutually reinforcing. And these perceptions have contributed during the last 4 years to a sizable overstretching of German resources. However, one has to ask oneself if Germany had actually showed the means of summoning up a new sort of national spirit to make a genuine success of unification, had the government started to distribute Mutterschaftskreuz medals for mothers who had given birth to more children to further the prowess of the German nation, had Germany become a great deal more heroic and a great deal less hesitant than it has been in the last few years, I wonder whether we abroad would have been very happy about this. It could well be that this rather indecisive Germany, a Germany which manifestly is not in a position to make a reappraisal of its priorities and remarshal its resources, a rather humble Germany in some ways, and certainly not a heroic Germany, it may well be that this is a Germany that we neighbours of Germany can best live with. Now, the economic and political balance sheet of unification is mixed. Germany has fulfilled neither the hopes of Chancellor Kohl that it would be flourishing by now, nor has it lived up to the expectations of Mrs. Thatcher that it would be dominant. It's strong, but it's not dominant. And I think the main problem is German weakness in coming years. Overall, the rolling back of communism from East Germany, and this was a process which 10 years ago, after all, would have cost the Third World War, has been positive, and it has also taken place with German orderliness. The withdrawal of 380,000 troops and airmen from the Soviet armed forces, the former occupiers of East Germany, which was completed earlier this year, this has been accomplished in peace and for a bill of only 15 billion D-marks. I would say that is cheap at the price. By overcoming division, Germany threw off Hitler's longest legacy, but it is not yet a normal land. It has regained nationhood, but it is still seeking a role. It has room to deploy national interests again, but it cannot yet define what they are. And for all the worries abroad about increased German might, the takeover of moribund East Germany has made the Federal Republic, compared with West Germany of 5 years ago, poorer rather than richer. The population is larger, the territory is larger, but I think Germany's political balance and its economic structure and its ability to govern itself has become weaker. The country's supreme national task, I think, is still to lower the psychological gulf across the old East-West divide. A poll by the Allensbach Research Institute 2 months ago revealed that only 28% of Germans in the East and 47% of those in the West regarded the German nation as one people. And the percentages at the time of unification were 45% in the East and 54% in the West, saying, wir sind ein Volk. So there's a psychological divide where there was before barbed wire. Psychological divide is preferable, definitely, but it is still a divide. And this split across the old East-West divide was, of course, reflected in the strong showing by the PDS on Sunday, who gained, the reformed communists in East Germany gained 20% of the votes in Eastern Germany. By the way, I do have to say that I find Chancellor Kohl's indignation at these, as he calls them, rot lackierten Faschisten, the red painted fascists, a little overdone. Chancellor Kohl seems to have no qualms whatsoever dealing with ex-communists who are now in government in Poland and Hungary. On the economic front, a heady post-unification boom in West Germany was followed in 1992 and 1993 by a sharp downturn. The shock of rapid adjustment to a D-mark economy brought a shattering 40% fall in gross domestic product in East Germany in 1990 and 1991. West Germany is now recovering faster than expected from the recession, while East Germany is growing at about 8 to 10% a year, although East German production is still below the 1989 level. However, recovery has been achieved at an immense cost. Taxes went up immediately in 1990. At the end of 1990, after the election, they're going to go up again on January the 1st. Net transfers to East Germany from the public sector, three quarters of which have been to finance consumption, have totaled 500 billion D-marks during the past 4 years. And despite all the protestations from Mr. Kohl and his perennially cheerful finance minister, Theo Weigel, that financing problems would soon be a thing of the past, the share of public spending and taxation in gross domestic product has risen by 5 percentage points since 1989. Public sector debt has doubled to 2,000 billion D-marks since 1990. And these are all heavy burdens on Germany's competitiveness. And they explain one of the reasons why this recovery of the last year has been bought at the expense of a great deal of demanning as companies move employment to cheaper labour sites abroad, also in Eastern and Central Europe. Now, these great fiscal imbalances in Bonn had a large impact on Germany's neighbours. In 1992-1993, there were grave setbacks. The recession across Western Europe was partly caused by the effects of German unification in prompting the Bundesbank to follow a tough monetary policy, the consequences of which were transmitted across the continent. The real culprits for the high interest rates in Frankfurt were not the Bundesbank, I think, far more the policymakers in Bonn. But Bonn's inability to put fiscal policy onto a sound footing left the Bundesbank really with little choice but to maintain high interest rates for a far longer period than was otherwise thought likely. And this was spread into other countries who were trying to keep their exchange rates steady against the D-mark up until 1992. Of course, one has also to say that one of the reasons for the failures of exchange rate management across Europe up until 1992 did not lie solely with the Germans. The European monetary system, in which Britain participated actively up until September 1992, should have been operated in a far more flexible manner. But this, one has to be said, is not a policy which the Germans themselves espoused during that time. Therefore, I'm a little suspicious of people at the Bundesbank rewriting history now and saying, we said that the D-mark should be revalued and the other countries should be devalued during that period. In fact, that was not part of the German policy after all during that time. This does show some increase in hindsight and also a distressing desire by the Bundesbank simply to rewrite history about that period. The September 1992 flare-up in the EMS was caused by a collision between some members' desire to keep their currencies steady against their D-mark and also by the eagerness to cut interest rates to ease the recession. The fact that the recession in Britain started far earlier than anywhere else in Europe exacerbated the conflict of interest which came to a head on Black Wednesday 1992. The short-term economic consequences for Britain of September the 16th may have been positive, but I think the longer-term political fallout has been dire, for this episode devalued not just the pound, but also the word of the Prime Minister. The 1993 unrest last summer, was even more explosive. The fundamentals of the French franc were much more solid than those of the Italian lira or the British pound. And partly because of this, the Bundesbank made far greater efforts to meet French wishes to support the franc. Nonetheless, the focus of the episode was the immense power of the international financial markets, capable of deploying astronomical sums of capital, much of it highly leveraged, this power to test central banks' resolve to maintain fixed exchange rates was shown in all its grandeur. And at times, on Friday, July the 30th, the Bank of France had to sell $100 million a minute to protect its currency. In the end, finance ministers at their meeting in Brussels shortly afterwards took the only sensible course, and they widened the fluctuation bands to avoid offering a firm exchange rate target for speculators. Now, since summer 1993, we have returned to relative stability for the core members of the European monetary system, but no country wants to return to the narrow margins which had been prevailing before summer 1993. This may be tactically sensible, but it does illustrate a fundamental lack of confidence about whether the exchange rates we now have in the EMS are necessarily the right ones for the day when we could have European Monetary Union. I would like to mention also just one other point about the setbacks for Europe in the last 3 or 4 years. The trend of declining acceptance in public opinion across the continent for European Union in general and Monetary Union in particular. And this had an important indirect impact on those bouts of monetary unrest that I mentioned. The referendum in Denmark in June 1992, the only very slender yes to Maastricht in the French referendum in September 1992, and the large support for anti-Maastricht parties shown in several countries, particularly in France, in the June 1994 European elections, were all part and parcel of this trend. the dog that has not yet barked is in Germany. And this, I think, is quite a triumph for Kohl, that although we know that there's a good deal of antagonism and opposition by the German public to giving up the D-mark, the smaller parties which have tried to espouse this and to put it on their electoral banner, the Republican Party, the party of Manfred Brunner, the Deutsche Volksunion, have made no headway whatsoever. And this actually is a remarkable success for Kohl, whose leitmotif has always been to prevent any party right of the CDU-CSU from gaining a foothold in power. And he succeeded very well in this on Sunday, whereas the SPD now has two parties to the left of it represented in the Bundestag. Therefore, Kohl's ability somehow to capture the right, yet nonetheless to maintain the hold over the center ground, without which any political party in Germany is going to be lost, has been an enormous success. It is, though, striking to note the consensus across the German political system for this question of the D-mark. And I do submit this is going to be one of the big questions still in the elections in 1998. Oscar Lafontaine, the shadow finance minister of the SPD, went on the record in the Bild Zeitung last Thursday saying that if the SPD came to power, they would renegotiate the Monetary Union Treaty to build in even firmer stability conditions for the Monetary Union. And this is quite exceptional that across the board you should have all politicians behaving more or less like members of the Bundesbank. And I do think this is going to give some pause for thought for other European politicians in the next few years. I should also mention simply the expansion of budget deficits during this period of recession in Europe. We've had 18 million people, more than 18 million people are now unemployed. Social security budgets have increased tremendously. The automatic effect of that has been that budget deficits more or less doubled over that period between the end of the 1980s and 1992. And these so-called convergence criteria, particularly the ones for the deficits, on today's measurements look unattainable. Certainly, because of the recession last year, one can say that the convergence criteria were met only by two countries as far as the deficit target is concerned. Five countries last year met the debt targets, six complied with the inflation targets, eight of the 12 met the interest rate targets. Last year, anyway, they looked like targets which were unattainable. And Germany this year may meet the deficit target, 3% of the budget deficit, 3% of GDP, but the debt target, because of this enormous effort to subsidize East Germany and to take over old East German debts, the debt for Germany, this 2,000 billion marks, will be more than 60% of GDP by the end of the year. That is more than the Maastricht reference level. I now turn to the elections on Sunday and the impact this will have on the future. Now, the election was really a victory, above all, for the polling institutes, above all, Allensbach, I think. And one can say that the polling institutes in Germany have become so good that one could actually save the cost of running the elections. Because this explained the lack of excitement, really, on Sunday evening. The polling forecasts and the exit polls at 6 o'clock all tended to show that there would be a narrow victory for the CDU-led coalition. But this was unusual for several reasons. Nonetheless, the three mainstream groupings in Germany, the CDU-CSU, the Liberal Free Democrats, the junior partner in the coalition, and the Social Democrats, together recorded their lowest combined score since 1953. So an unusual degree of fragmentation because of the PDS and because of the Greens, which both managed to squeeze into the Bundestag. The turnout, despite all the massive amount of interest in rallies across the country in the 3 or 4 weeks previously, where Chancellor Kohl, I think, himself was supposed to talk to rallies with 1 million people, the turnout at 79.1% was the third lowest on record since the first post-war elections in Germany in 1949. The CDU-CSU score, 41.5%, was about 2 percentage points lower than in 1990, and was in fact the lowest score for the Conservatives since 1949, when in the first election it was an unusually low 31%. And this score was about 5 points below the average for the previous 11 elections, not counting the 1949 poll. So the true story of Sunday is not that Chancellor Kohl can feel pleased for himself, although he no doubt is feeling pleased with himself. It is that the CDU has slumped to its worst result since 1949. The SPD score was about 3 points up from 1990, but it was still quite a long way below the average for the previous 10 or 11 elections since the 1950s. Now, for all his credentials as a supporter of European Union, and for all the robust confidence that he's been demonstrating in the last few days, I think Mr. Kohl's victory margin will add to his reasons for caution in many ways, both over economic policy making and over the further extension of supranational European decision making. I think he's going to be preoccupied less perhaps with the 10-seat majority in the Bundestag, because I don't think German deputies are all that rebellious in most of their careers. He'll be concerned, I think, more with squaring the SPD in the Bundesrat, which has a nearly two-thirds majority and does have important influence about on legislation, particularly of the fiscal variety. So I think he may well be preoccupied by domestic politics. This will divert his attention from the international stage, where, of course, he's now one of the most seasoned and long-lived leaders who we have in Europe. Therefore, I think the question of Germany taking a more positive and internationalist line, for instance, on the deployment of the Bundeswehr out of area, will go on the back burner. I also think that the question of Germany taking a permanent seat in the Security Council will not be something which the Germans are going to be pressing for in a very insistent form during the next 4 years. Partly because if you have political power, you do need to have some kind of military capacity to back that up. I also think that in view of the potential conflicts between the goals of intensifying integration in the west of the continent and extending it to the east, Kohl will need to tread a very narrow dividing line. Now, public support, according to all the opinion polls, and I do trust these Allensbach opinion polls, for deepening integration in the present European Union seems to have fallen during the last 4 or 5 years. This was a trend which was taking place before German unification. And according to the opinion polls, much higher priority, is now given to widening the European Union, particularly to the Visegrad countries. Sunday's referendum result in Finland brought us nearer to the goal of bringing in 3 or 4 new members at the beginning of next year. And this, I think, will also add momentum to the project of somehow bringing in Poland and Hungary and the Czech Republic and Slovakia by some period around the year 2000. What we are certainly not seeing is the shaping up of some sort of a super state. And I don't think that the people in Scandinavia, and certainly not Jörg Haider in Austria, who gained 22% of the vote in the Austrian general election 2 weeks ago, I don't think this is what they have in mind. We're not seeing a super state being formed in Europe. It seems to me that we're seeing a much more amorphous constellation of states. The path Europe will take, though, will depend crucially on the outcome of the French presidential election, and this is going to have a far bigger impact than any of the conceivable results last Sunday in Germany, since the SPD is basically signed up to a pro-European consensus, the same as Mr. Kohl. If Jacques Delors takes over in the Élysée Palace, then he and Mr. Kohl will have a very good opportunity to extend their close European cooperation built up during Mr. Delors' 10 years in Brussels. However, it's notable that even Mr. Delors, almost in language which Mrs. Thatcher might have used, has recently been quoted as saying that the Maastricht Treaty was over-ambitious and poorly drafted. One wonders who drafted it, but he has apparently said this. In his interview with Libération just a few days ago, he certainly said he wasn't afraid of Germany, and he seemed to indicate he'd rather have a German-dominated Europe than a wishy-washy free trade zone of the sort espoused by the British, or the sort supposedly espoused by the British, but I wouldn't be so sure whether the French electorate will go along with that. If the new French president is from the right, either Mr. Balladur or Mr. Schirach, then the opportunities for Franco-German cooperation may well be constrained by a slightly more nationalistic turn to French politics. So we're going to have to wait and see about the new constellation in the Élysée Palace. Now, during the preparations for the 1996 intergovernmental conference to revise the Maastricht Treaty, Mr. Kohl seems likely to revive the German demand made originally in 1991 for monetary union to be accompanied by a full-scale European political union. This was a very important subtext of that recent CDU-CSU paper. But any movement towards a federal Europe could be stymied not only by objections from other member states, but also by opposition from within Germany itself for further transfers of powers to European Union institutions. It's significant that Mr. Kohl no longer says he wants a United States of Europe, which had been emblazoned on his banner for many years. And this was a move spurred by opinion polls in Germany during the last 2 years, showing that a large majority of Germans now oppose a federally organized Europe. The majority is something like 5-1, again, according to Elisabeth Müller-Neumann's Allensbach Institute, now say that this is opposed by the Germans. There's a lot of confusion, of course, in this country about what Mr. Kohl actually wants, and this is partly because his use of the language is often somewhat vague. I noticed this in the Times today, where we had an editorial on the right-hand side of the page saying Mr. Kohl was still a man with whom Mr. Major could do business, because he may well indeed be able to find common cause on a free trade zone with Mr. Kohl. That was on the right-hand page. On the left-hand page, there was another article saying Mr. Major must be cursing Mr. Cole's victory because this is paving the way for a European super state. So that's plurality of opinion for you, as the Russians now say. I tend to think that the truth will lie in between. And as I say, we are not, whatever Mr. Lamont thinks, we're not heading for a super state, because the Germans don't want it. If they wanted it, we probably would, but they don't, so we won't. I simply now would like to turn to the outlook for monetary union. I mean, this is a question of political will. Germany will have to give up more in monetary union than any other member of the European community. If the Germans want it to happen, it will happen. But if they don't, then I can see it being postponed. My own hunch is that EMU will happen in the early years of the next century with a larger group than envisaged at present in the core, and that the single currency will be, to all intents and purposes, the D-mark. And I'd like to comment just on that paper in Bonn a few weeks ago. This was interpreted here as some sort of conspiracy with the French to gang up on Britain. Of course, it wasn't at all. I mean, it had been discussed with France, but the French were as much the targets of that paper as were the British, and there was some very strong language towards the French in that paper. If Italy was excluded from a core group for European Union, this would weaken France's position in an otherwise German-dominated core. And I think that's one of the reasons why whoever will be in power in France might well think twice about signing up for a German-dominated core in the next few years. Germany wishes to maintain control over the D-mark for as long as it harbours any doubts at all about the reliability and the stability of the other EU members, i.e. for quite a long time. And in the meantime, in Germany's policies, we're likely to see Germany playing for time, making the right noises, trying as much as possible to act the good European. If anything goes wrong along the road to EMU, the Germans are likely to blame the others, more in sorrow than in anger, for not fulfilling various conditions that, while arduous, are absolutely necessary for the success of a single currency. And Mr. Kohl might, in fact, be quite pleased to have a slender majority and to be able to hide behind the SPD in some ways if he decides at one time the EMU targets and the EMU timetable should be delayed. I noticed, in fact, he gave an interview to The Independent a few weeks ago in which he said the timetable was not basically up for discussion, which I thought was rather piquant, because it really showed that maybe it could be up for discussion. Britain, I should just say a few points about Britain. Britain is patently in the horns of a dilemma. John Major gave this William and Mary speech a few weeks ago. It reminded me really of William, the boy gangster in the Richmal Crompton novel, because John Major obviously doesn't want to be part of the gang that's being formed on the continent, but he and his band of outlaws here in Britain would be jolly sorry if they went ahead and formed a rival gang without him. So Britain neither wants to be in and certainly doesn't want to be left out. Britain will be playing for time over this. I think, though, the real problem, and this, I think, is the real crisis point in certainly in the European Union at the moment, is in Italy. A combination of Italy's debt problems and the widespread belief abroad, which were apparently confirmed by the CDU-CSU paper, that Italy will not be part of the top tier of the community, could lead to a self-fueling crisis, both financial and political, in Rome. And if there was a risk of a real north-south split in Italy, and I remember Mr. Amato, the then Prime Minister, making some reference to this point in a lecture here, which I was happy to attend just about 18 months ago, if there was a real risk of a north-south split in Italy, I believe that Bonn could actually rein back some of its preparations for a core group. If there was a choice between somehow saving Italy as a member of a more amorphous and loose Europe and somehow leaving Italy to its fate outside a core, then I think the government in Bonn, whoever it is, would actually be stricken by conscience and would somehow say, we must save Italy. Whether or not they could or not, I do not know, but that would be the reaction. Italy would rather, Germany would rather save Italy than press on towards some sort of a dream of a core which would leave Italy to itself. If the single currency, which does come about one day, is the D-mark, it would be called the Euro-mark, of course, this may not be such a bad thing. A D-mark standard could provide a guarantee of economic solidity. Would a D-mark standard prove politically acceptable to the rest of Europe? That is a good question, which I cannot answer. An even better one, though, is would abandonment of the D-mark prove acceptable to the German people? The final date for monetary union is set under the Maastricht Treaty on the 1st of January 1999, a few weeks after the 1998 elections. Therefore, while the 1994 elections decided Kohl's future, the 1998 elections could decide the future of the D-mark. No respect to Mr. Kohl, but I think there's no doubt about which decision is more important. Thank you.
David, thank you very much for a fascinating and deeply knowledgeable lecture. David Marsh has kindly said that he would welcome questions for, I think, perhaps 10 to 15 minutes. Have to be brief. I hope if you could stand up when you're asking your question and keep it just to one or two sentences, we'll manage to get in five or six. Who would like to start? I can't see any of you up at the top because the lights are out, so please, there's one at the front here in the balcony.
The issue of sovereignty that seems to come through the idea of individual currency, how do you reconcile that with your last proposal?
Well, I don't reconcile it. I think it's a very difficult question. So it's not a proposal, it's more a forecast. But I forecast a lot of argument.
Crisp question, crisp answer, please.
You referred, David, to a humble, not heroic Germany, and I wanted to ask if you'd be willing to speculate on what the next possible generation of German leaders might, how they might change this. Are they going to remain humble, and I would say patient, or will they become more heroic? Because I know you know some of them rather well.
You're just thinking of my wife, aren't you, who's got neither. I think the fundamental point is that the Germans don't want to continually be reminded that they have to somehow be traipsing around with the sins of their fathers and grandfathers. And this is why I think some of the rhetoric used in Bonn is actually counterproductive and could lead to more impatience than might otherwise be provoked. I've been very heartened by the fact that the right-wing parties have not been a political channel for large-scale unrest, youth revolt against the older generation. But I must say, I think that Germany will remain rather preoccupied with itself. And I think the younger generation of leaders, let us look at Sharping or La Fontaine. I can't really think of many of the younger generation of leaders in the CDU, which is actually one of the problems. Volker Höhr is also not somebody, I think, who's going to be following an unpredictable foreign policy course. So I think Germany is going to be more inward-looking than outward-looking. Whether or not they are patient, it depends what they're being patient about.
There's a question here in the middle.
Suppose what happened, if Germany were to accept, so if Germany, critics don't come in, you have a foreign critic, don't come in, you have this East Russia.
Well, is that actually up as a proposition? I mean, Germany is certainly buying back very large parts of that area, one has to say that. And I think the fears of people, say, in the Czech Republic, that this will somehow become just a 17th Land of Germany, do have to be taken seriously. I mean, Germany, by its geographical position and by its economic strength, is obviously extending its economic power and prowess all over Central and Eastern Europe. I don't think you can actually... You can obviously stop Sudeten Germans flooding across the frontiers and demonstrations for the return of their former livelihood. You can certainly stop that with the due force of law. It's probably difficult to stop, say, Poles or Czechs selling land to Germans. I mean, I think that is a very difficult problem. What I would like to see as a slightly more beneficial counter to this is British and French economic interests playing a greater role in both those countries. And I think that would be a far better way of preventing the Germans from building up what could be a destabilizing power in some areas of those countries.
Alan Skip.
Sorry, which Ottawa talks? Well, I'm surprised you think I'm being complacent, really. That's quite a compliment. Actually, I can think of 100 ways that Cole is a more unpleasant person than in this rather
childish jibe he made about the Danes after the election. I'm certainly not saying he's a big cuddly teddy bear. I think you're probably listening to somebody else's speech on that. Nor do I think that one of the board members of BMW, as Horst Telchik now is without any regard for the commercial advantages of spreading Germany's superior labour and workforce and technical capabilities across Eastern Europe, and also getting it at a low price. I mean, these people are obviously fairly steely in the way that they go about their business. What I don't see is an agenda for grabbing power in some sort of way that we, as in this country, defenders of a kind of liberal market democracy, would be against. I don't see the Germans sort of bending the rules of the international power game in the way that they manifestly did in the 30s and the 40s, in a way, in a kind of scurrilous fashion, which is sometimes represented here. I think the word domination is actually not right. I mean, I think domination is right for a company like BMW. I mean, BMW's agenda is obviously to dominate that section of the world motor industry, just like the goal of BASF or Siemens might be to dominate their sections of world markets. I think we're getting a little bit away from talking about where countries like Germany, which are now spreading their technology and their employment into other countries, are there as the dominant force. And I think we are living in a world slightly beyond that, slightly 19th century sort of description. My goals are certainly benign, and my objective for Europe is benign, and it could be that the scenario I've sketched out is benign. We will have to meet here again in 10 years' time.
Right, I'm going to take two more questions, and I think we'll have to call a halt, one here and one here. Please.
Well, I think I would just give a very short answer. I think Kohl will go down as the saviour if he stops the D-mark from somehow being given away. They will both be saviours. I do know that Mr. Tietmeyer and Mr. Kohl have had quite a lot of conversations in the last 3 years. I think Mr. Kohl now thinks very similarly to Mr. Tietmeyer.
Please.
Well, I suppose it depends whether those Germans will go back to Germany or stay in London, really. I mean, a lot of Germans I speak to, for some reason, they quite like it here, and they don't always want to go back. I mean, I think it's a good point that we should probably have as many British students studying in Germany as German students here, and that would be far better than any amount of summit conferences and directives from Brussels. That would do far more to promote some sort of better understanding. But I mean, I still nonetheless do think that Germany, with a large country with large problems, will be more self-centered. And I wouldn't blame it for being so in the next 10 to 15 years than it has been in the last 15 years.
Right, David, well, thank you very much indeed. Perhaps not in the London School of Economics, but in Britain as a whole, the subject of Germany has often been treated with rather too much hot air and rather too little cool analysis. And so I think it's rather salutary that we've had a lecture tonight which has emphasised the cool analysis and I think has been very illuminating in so doing. I wasn't present at the lecture you referred to with the good jokes of Otto Pohl, but I'm sure that your jokes were well up to par in comparison to his. And I would like to thank you for those and for the lecture as a whole. Thank you very much.